Welcome to the inaugural episode of the Campaign School. I'm here with my partner and a brilliant political mind, Washington insider, and all-around brilliant, wonderful, amazing man, Jordan Page. Hello.
Hi, how you doing? Thank you for the lovely intro. Happy to be here on your inaugural cast.
Yes, it's been well worth the wait, I'd say. It's been a long time in the making. And the reason Jordan's here is not just because he is an incredible political mind, but in his long career in DC at this point, he's had many insights and perhaps the best backroom, over drinks kind of commentary that has shifted a many strategist's mind. Like you've certainly had your share of unofficial campaigning and lobbying discussions that have changed hearts and minds. Would you agree?
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say. I thought you were just going to say, well, it was convenient. But you know, I like to get into the soup. Sure.
Okay. So I'm going to move a little closer and we are going to go over a few very exciting questions.
All right.
Because you and I have had many a heated, I won't say debate because we usually agree, but what is going on with the world type part existential crisis, part emotional inventory, part recap of the news and how much CNN can we take discussion on the daily, right?
And part angry rant. There's, you know, a lot of angry ranting that also occurs in these, but yeah.
Angry ranting.
Yeah.
Indignation.
Righteous or otherwise.
Indignation and my occasional outrage fatigue.
Sure.
Yeah. Tell the people a little bit about your job and what you do and how you came to DC.
So at my job, I am a I'm a risk manager with the Environmental Protection Agency. You know, I've been told I'm part of the deep state. Apparently, that's
who
me.
Who told you that?
Well, that's what they call us. So anyone that is, you know, a federal employee that's, you know, career, right? So you're there for as long as you want to be there. You're not, you know, appointed. You don't come and change with the administration. Like, that is literally the definition of the deep state.
Being untouchable, though.
Being well, you know, there are administrative rules that are there in good place for why we are that way, but it's you know, it's certainly a stable industry. But it's you know, it's a position that, you know, every day I work and interact with a lot of very intelligent, very passionate people that are, you know, serious about environmental protection and making sure we don't all die or get poisoned. I work in the Office of Pesticides, and you know, in a nutshell, what we do is we make sure that pesticides that are sold and used in the United States are safe for your health, you know, children, animals, nature, you know, trying to make sure that we don't burn everything down, trying to keep our homes pest-free and our crops growing. So,
but you're working government.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't end just there, really. Your political interests are greater than that. And how would you characterize the responsibility of an informed voter? I would consider you to be an informed voter. So what does that mean to you?
I try to be an informed voter. It's difficult to be, you know, 100% informed on everything that is, you know, relevant to the world in your life. But, you know, such is the nature of democracy. But, yeah, I mean, you know, to me, being an informed voter just means having a reasonable grasp on, you know, the most important issues, you know, facing all of us on a short-term and long-term basis, and also having an understanding of the positions of people representing us on those issues. So that, I think, sounds like a fairly explanation, but in practice, you know, we both know and have seen that you know, sometimes that's difficult to, that's a difficult standard to meet on both ends. So
who do you think has it harder to meet that kind of standard of being an informed decision maker? The left, the right, you think it's not polar that way?
I would like to think it shouldn't be polar that way, but, you know, just my own opinion is that, you know, especially given what we've seen in the past, you know, kind of 15 to 20 years, on the right, you know, it just seems to me that, you know, voter motivation and, you know, motivation is more kind of linked to feelings rather than actual information.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that, you know, that ideology is able to get by on making people feel a certain way, whether that be, you know, through fear, through nativism, through certain phobias. You know, they're able to get results in engagement and participation through that, rather than, you know, on the left or, you know, progressives that attempt, you know, or you know, at least try to foster engagement in policy based on, you know, facts and having evidence for things. And you know,
we have a saying in the sort of political strategist world that Republicans fall in line and Democrats fall in love.
Sure.
Which kind of summarizes, I think, where you're coming from. You started talking a little bit about voter apathy, and we were both, I think, together during the election results of 2016 and what that was like, and many a important discussion around apathy. Do you think voters today are much more motivated to vote this time around, or are we facing any similar apathy as we did in 2016? Because we know what happened and what a big part apathy was in why we are where we are right now.
Yeah, my sense is that there would be less overall apathy amongst everybody, really. It seems like, you know, just out in front of this, like there, that we're primed to have, you know, probably the most engagement that we've seen since, you know, possibly the 2008 election. And, you know, that's assuming that, you know, people aren't dissuaded by, you know, things like the pandemic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, affecting, you know, actual voter turnout, or, you know, lack of faith in the post office, or lack of ability of the post office to do that. But, you know, it seems to me like on the front end, people understand that given where we are, what we've seen for the past 4 years, and just really just what we've seen in 2020, you know, I don't sense a lot of apathy for the process, even if, you know, we're being honest, the ticket, you know, maybe isn't what would have gotten most people as excited. But I think most people understand that, you know, not participating this time is not, you know, is not going to be acceptable. So
I'm going to ask a not helpful question.
Sure.
What type of ticket do you think would have been more exciting or actually gotten the kind of mobilization and engagement that we would maybe surpass 2000, like an Obama type of
You know, given the options that we had, it's tough to say. It's, you know, it's kind of easy to say, you know, possibly anyone except for Joe Biden might have been more exciting, but you know, there are reasons why he won the primary, and
like, I have
are
a there theory also as to why he's actually the best candidate.
Yeah,
well,
I tend to agree with that, and I think there are reasons for that as well. But mm-hmm. you know, even though we had like a tremendously huge slate, right? There were people that would have been more exciting than Biden, but perhaps, my gut tells me may have been problematically polarizing for, various reasons.
So you talked about, too, how you think there is less apathy. I have kind of thrown out the blueprint because we all know how much faith to put in polls, right? And how...
None.
Huh. that being said, there's still an important tool to inform how you campaign.
Sure.
Maybe not an explanation of election results, but certainly a strategy in how to approach your potential voters and engaging them. But I feel like the folks who are apathetic are still, maybe not in quantity, but they're still really loud. And I don't know if people are talking about abstaining this time the way they did before, and how many people who voted independent and third party. Yeah. Just do you remember how, like,
I think,
incensed you were?
I think my sense is that there's a difference this time. I think last time, in 2016, we heard a lot of, one is the same as the other, or, Hillary's just as bad as Trump.
Well, I still hear that now. I still hear people saying that Trump and Biden are the same, which I think is ridiculous.
I agree that that's ridiculous. I think that, the difference between 2016 and now is, I think that in 2016, neither, even though they were both had been public figures for, decades at that point. Neither one had a political track record that you could point to and say, okay, well, this is what you're going to get. At this point, now that we've, made it through almost 4 years of Trump. I don't know how, but here we are. But I think at this point, now that we're here, now that we've seen, what President Trump has to offer, anyone that is saying that it's an equivalent choice at this point is that's not really an opinion that I would put too much stock in, given that the evidence and the track record is there to see. And I also, I haven't done polls myself. This is, just gut feeling, but it seems like people that are saying that seems like a far less, prevalent group or amount of people that would be saying that this time than we had last time.
But what do you say to those people who are actually making that sort of false equivalence?
I don't think there's anything I can say to those people. I don't think, it's if someone, chooses...
It's not about the facts for
them.
Yeah,
if someone chooses to believe or chooses to, espouse the opinion that somehow Trump and Biden are an equivalent choice, it's, I can't really, even debate that. Like, that's... I look at that as people trying to, gain attention or significance by expressing a wildly contrarian opinion.
Right, that makes them feel special.
Sure, but again, it's not, you can't say that, oh, because the only thing that they have in common is that they're both two old white guys that, mm-hmm. that the choice is so foregone that you shouldn't even participate. Like, if that's honestly someone's belief, then, I kind of leave them to that. And, I think it's better to focus on people that would, like to be informed on what it is that Joe Biden has to offer going forward. So
for the folks who are still apathetic, or the ones that don't think they're...
And again, like, I don't even necessarily consider that apathy. Like, if that's an opinion that you're saying, like, you clearly, you're not apathetic. You just, I think...
Your form of protest
I think you're just trying to, cash in on some sort of, outrage cachet. Like, it,
Outrage cachet. Ooh, I like that. Yeah. Just because, I personally find the abstention to be so disrespectful. Like, there are outright voter suppression efforts at all levels happening systemically for communities that are that look like us, frankly, to keep them from going to the polls. And so many people who have dedicated their entire lives to voting rights, I find it outright disrespectful and to not exercise it.
I can understand that point of view. I should say that, you know, among, you know, the people that I've heard or, you know, observed say that they're not interested in voting for, you know, one reason or another. And again, like, I think that attitude is different than, oh, well, I don't know how to vote, or I don't know what any of this means, or I don't know when election day is. I think that's a different set of people. But people that have said, oh, well, like, you know, I don't want to vote for this reason or that reason, or everybody's the same, or whatever, that I've actually heard that from a pretty good, you know, cross section of different people, you know, people that are POCs versus, maybe some, you know, white folks, to where, you know, they just sit back and say, okay, you know, both sides are pretty ridiculous, but the outcome doesn't really affect what's going on with me either way. So, you know, I'm not going to participate in the tribalism here, you know? And so, you know, one of those is kind of a position of privilege. Like, I'm going to be fine either way. So, like, I'm not going to, you know, jump in this fray. And there's, you know, again, like, kind of the outrage cachet that, you know, that a term I just flipped, where it's, oh, well, like, you know, I want credit for just trashing everybody. And, you know, like, look at me, I'm not voting for anybody because I'm so beyond woke that, you know, I'm past it. Right. So
you're saying that there's a small contingency of political clout chasers that are pursuing that by deliberately not engaging politically.
Well, that's, you know, and again, I, you know, that's kind of the only conclusion I can come from, you know, just from my observation. Right. Because, mm-hmm. you know, and there have been lots of studies and lots of academic papers and, you know, all sorts of work done on reasons that people choose not to participate. Like, you know, I just outlined two of them. You know, of course, there's all sorts of, you know, religious reasons, you know, maybe that people don't participate. And there's also just, like, you know, genuine, lack of information about civics and the democratic process, right? Which is, you know, why, you know, people, oh, well, I'm not registered, I don't know what this means, I don't know what's a Democrat, mm-hmm. what's a Republican. Like, in Washington, it's hard to imagine that that exists. But, like, that's you know, that happens, you know. But yeah, I think given, you know, again, you know, I'll say what we've seen in 2020 and over the past 4 years, you know, it would just seem to me that the stakes should be clear to a majority of Americans, you know, regardless of where you're coming from.
So this I find this interesting because the stakes seem so clear. Do you find that Democrats and progressives are in any way taking campaigning and actual voter engagement for granted, right? That the many people will say, well, he's just the not Trump candidate.
Well, and yeah, people are saying that, but I would hope they're not taking anything for granted. Like, that's how they screwed up last time.
Well, there are many barriers, I think, to having the kind of visibility and effective campaign. You mentioned the pandemic. Mm-hmm. That's central.
Yeah.
All the voter suppression tactics are central.
Yeah.
Not even being able to host campaign rallies in the traditional sense. I mean, we saw how different the DNC and RNC were this year.
Yep.
Everything is different such that I don't think we're actually going to necessarily know who the president is the night of. Like, there's...
Oh, we're definitely not going to know that.
Okay, so what's your prediction? How long before... Will he concede? Do you think he'll concede at all? And if he does, when? Or are you thinking that he's going to have to be run out of there in handcuffs the way I do?
Well, so you dropped a couple of different questions there.
Yeah.
I mean, first I'll say, you know, with regards to, you know, the engagement of Democrats and, you know, taking you know, votes for granted. I would hope that's a lesson they learned from 2016. Like, you can't do that. You know, I think in this case, being not Trump gets you pretty far, but not far enough, definitely. So
what's the difference there? Does it take you to do you win? Is that enough to win?
No, it's not. Not being Trump is not enough to win. Because, you know, this is the guy that has, and, you know, we've talked about this too, like, you know, kind of a really, solid and, you know, larger than anyone is comfortable with, you know, base of support, right? That,
so what do you think is missing? Just that actual groundswell of the base?
Which base? The progressive base? Well, it's, you know, the way the electoral system is set up, right? Like, we know that it is set up in a way in which it is able to amplify the influence of you know, rural voters, and, you know, and in a way in which, you know, they're, you know, able to continue seeing success without necessarily winning the popular vote, right? So, you know, if being not Trump gets you the popular vote, you need more than that.
So I think I've shared this with you, mm-hmm. but I have a position that I've had to really think about and come to the conclusion that Biden is, in fact, the best candidate for the moment.
Right.
I would love your thoughts.
Yeah.
Because.
Okay. Well, let me get to your second mm-hmm. question before sure. I jump on that. What happens after the election is decided?
Oh, yeah. What do you think?
I think after the election is decided, immediately nothing good happens either way.
But do you think it'll be decided the day of?
It's definitely not going to be decided the day of. I think you're looking at, you know, at least a couple of weeks of uncertainty. I think, and, you know, I think.
You think that'll be due strictly to mail-in ballots, or do you think that's going to be accusations?
No, I think it's going to be a lot of things. I think it's going to be a mess. And, you know, for anyone that is going to be hearing this that is old enough to remember the 2000 election, I think we're going to be looking at something.
Tell the people.
What about?
The 2000.
Well, yeah.
Bush Gore, Florida.
Yeah. So, uh-huh. You know, Bush Gore, Florida. Well, you know, if you remember, like, I think, what were we in? Seventh grade at the time, but we're, like, we both remember that.
Well, I was here. I've been in DC my whole life, so it was yeah.
Well, yeah, you were here. I was, you know, where I grew
up. It was a talking point.
It, you know, but again, like, you know, that election, you know, happened, and, you know, Florida, I think, at the end of election night was still in question. Like, you know, they were counting their ballots, like, well into the next day, the next week or something like that, and they had all these issues with voting machines and a hanging chad or whatever that is, and, you know, there was a lawsuit the Supreme Court had to decide. But, like, you know, all of this, I think it was, you know, well into December, right, mm-hmm. before we knew for sure who the president was going to be. So, you know, I think that we are inevitably going to be looking at another scenario like that, where the actual outcome, you know, we may not know for, you know, perhaps several weeks. And it's, as long as everyone understands that, like, I think, you know, maybe they're, and, like, you know, the press has been warnings about that, right? Like, they've been sounding the alarm on that. With regards to, like, okay, like, there are going to be a lot of absentee ballots, a lot of ballots, like, not cast in person. It's going to take longer to count those. And on top of that, you know, we expect that, you know, a lot of the swing state contests are going to be probably pretty close, right? Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, on top
any
of that, you're going to have
swing states?
No.
No. Too big of a swing.
Yeah, no, I don't. Your Floridas and Ohios and what else you get, like, North Carolinas.
A lot of things are in play.
Yeah,
But the play is going micro. I mean, it's even down to the congressional districts, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to be wild, not just at the top of the ballot, but I think down the ballot as well. Because if the presidential is going to be contested, as we think it probably will be,
yeah,
who's to say that any congressional district, gerrymandering aside, with less than 1%, maybe even 3% difference, might not also be scrutinized the same way?
Yeah, this is going to be
a cluster.
I'm pretty sure this is going to be like the messiest election, you know, probably, certainly we've ever seen, and most likely anyone, you know, older than us, you know, boomers on down have ever seen. Like, it's going to be
messy. I mean, like any other populist government, it's going to be that kind of messy election.
Well, that is what happens in populist
governments.
Exactly.
That's,
yeah. And like, you know, you'd asked earlier, like, okay, if the guy like loses, like, what is he going to do? Well, you know, he's going to throw a bitch fit. He's going to, he's already said that if he loses, it's, you know, it's an illegitimate outcome. You know, there was fraud, things were tampered with, this, like, so.
Yeah, he's already laying the groundwork.
Yeah,
there.
So, you know, and what's unclear at this point, that is terrifying. What's unclear at this point is, I don't think most of us even understand what kind of structure we have in place to arbitrate this. Like, whose job is it to, you know, verify this, verify that? Like, who's going to, you know, call this thing at the end? Because
I mean, he already tried postponing the election altogether.
Well, yeah, but like I think, you know, because so if you understand like how elections actually work, there's no you know, national arbitrator of who won, right? Like, mm-hmm. every state is kind of responsible for figuring out that on the state level, right? So you're gonna have, you know, where it's close, right, you're gonna have like this series of state by state messes to sort out, right, that, you know, no one can really influence except for you know, the individual state election apparatuses, because like those are who determine where the electoral votes go.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously, like, as we saw in 2000, like, yeah, that, like, in some cases, you know, that might have to be elevated. And, like, that ended up being the Supreme Court. I don't know what happens if there are, you know, multiple cases that need outside arbitration, which there very well might be. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. Like, you know, and that's kind of a detail that I haven't heard discussed very much. But yeah, like, when you get down to the brass tacks of, like, okay, if stuff is messy and in question, like, whose job is it to sort it out and decide what actually happened?
Secretaries of state by each state. Cause that's a whole look. Yeah. They are also not impartial. Like,
they're not impartial because state secretaries of state are also, you know, part they're elected. I mean, we saw this in 2018, you know, in the Georgia election, where the current governor of Georgia was the mm-hmm. Secretary of State of Georgia at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So he was literally in charge of counting the votes.
That wasn't even a shadow campaign. That was outright visible voter suppression.
Yeah. So, you know, what assurances do we have that something similar wouldn't happen this time? And, you know, unfortunately, the answer is none. Because, you know, this administration and their allies have demonstrated time and time again that they will do anything that they can get away with, right? So yeah, if they can do it, they will. And if you cry foul, they will throw their hands up and be like, you know, well, shit, fuck you. Like,
so before we wrap up, you have family in New York, in Florida, in Georgia, and you live in Maryland yourself, right? How different...
I forgot California.
Oh, California, that's right. And Texas too, right?
And Texas, and South Carolina, and Maryland.
That's true.
And abroad. Anyway, yeah.
So how anecdotally, how different have their experience at the ballot box been? Because even across those states, there are different timelines as when people are, as to when people are receiving their ballot, when it's due. Some people need to have already received it and need to drop it by a specific date. Whereas here in DC, for instance, you can even go up to the very last day, like the last day you can ask for a mail-in ballot, I believe is actual election day, right? Which would then mean it's 2 weeks from then. Like, it's a whole set of rules, again, to your point about it being state by state. What have you heard
So I haven't reached out to a lot of family yet about what's been happening already. You know, I know that,
but they're all definitely voting.
Yeah, everyone's definitely voting. You know, I think North Carolina was the first state to actually open up voting. I think in this case, you know, it's, I would almost say that, like, yeah, if you are able to get a mail-in ballot early and do that, then, you know, go ahead, if that's what you'd like to do. But I've been saying that, you know, I plan to either vote in person or drop my mail-in ballot off to a polling place in person, because I'd rather not leave this in the hands of the post office. And also, like, you know, I would say to, you know, most people, you know, family and otherwise, like, unless you're, you know, elderly or in a compromised, you know, situation, like, you know, put on a mask, put on two masks, put on three masks, and, you know, go ahead and vote in person. Like, you know, we were all out there protesting, you know, earlier this year, and this is the most effective form of protest that I can think of. So, I think your first and best option is to get it done the old fashioned way, just so there's no way that they can, you know, conveniently lose your ballot or any of that kind of skullduggery or nonsense that we all know is coming. So,
well, I think we should leave on that high note, because you just told the people that this is the best form of protest that there is. So, I thank you. I think we can dig in maybe next week and we can talk more about my theory as to why I think Biden is in fact the best candidate for the moment, and would love your thoughts on that. Not only is Jordan Page incredibly brilliant and politically insightful and highly qualified and very well educated, also my best friend and really hot and sitting right next to me, and I'm a lucky girl. So thank you. Any other final thoughts on our inaugural go round at this?
Well, this was really great and a lot of fun. I hope to, you know, join you again soon, and, you know, can't wait to hear your other upcoming guests. So, good stuff.
Yeah, hopefully that's still okay. We're just a bunch of nerds. So, all right, this has been The Campaign School with Alma Molina. Thanks.